Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today offers a little science behind why some plants thrive and others fail in our backyard gardens. Lee Reich is a horticulturist who worked at Cornell as for the United States Department of Agriculture in plant and soil research before shifting to sharing his knowledge with gardeners through books like Weedless Gardening, The Pruning Book, or Landscaping with Fruit. He currently writes a gardening column for the Associated Press and writes for a number of gardening magazines. His latest book is titled The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden, which in layman's language describes some of the science behind all sorts of gardening issues, from propagating and planting to pruning, soil maintenance, flowering and fruiting, as well as plant stress from weather to disease or weeds. He joins us from what he calls his farm den, more than a garden, less than a farm, in New Paltz, New York. Lee Reich is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Lee Reich, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This Ever Curious Gardener combines a little bit of science. It's not a whole lot of science, but just enough science to give you some background on useful techniques for gardens, whether it's fruit gardens or vegetable gardens or flower gardens. What made you decide to write this book?
I attribute it to that it probably was sort of in my subconscious for a while, but just one day I was making compost, which I for decades, and it's one of my favorite things. And I was just became aware that while I was making the compost, I wasn't just throwing things onto the compost, but I have these bins, a number of compost bins, so I wasn't just throwing stuff into the bins willy-nilly. I was actually doing it more deliberately, thinking of, taking into account what was going in. I had hay, I had manure, some soil I was sprinkling on, some old vegetables, and other more odd stuff. But as I was adding that stuff, I was thinking how, and then as I added it, I would add a certain amount, and I'd pat it down to make it so it wouldn't be too much air in it. And then I'd add water, but not too much water. And I was thinking how everything I was doing really spoke to what I had learned in graduate school, because I was in graduate school in agriculture for a number of years, and I was in research with Cornell and the USDA. So everything I was doing was speaking to that and what I've read and my experience, and it was really the science that I was putting it all together to make what I, in all modesty, I have to say, really nice compost. And so then I started thinking how there's a lot of things that go on in the garden, that same thing, that I'm using some of the science that I've learned and practiced, just using it in little ways in the garden just to make everything grow a little better. And it's really quite rewarding. First of all, it's very interesting, I think, the science. Like, I do something different, and then something different happens. Or maybe I think something different is going to happen, and it doesn't. And my garden's pretty good, and I think one reason it's pretty good is because of that science.
Now, at the end of the book, you talk about using the scientific method when you make a change in your garden, actually setting aside another plant for a control to see if what you did actually made a difference. Do you actually practice that in your garden?
Yeah, sometimes, and it's hard to do. You know, it's just that people often come up to me and they say, well, they did such and such in the garden, and they got great results, and, you know, they're attributing what they did to the results. And I have to restrain myself, but sometimes I say, well, yeah, my vegetable garden really looks good, and every time I walk in, I click my heels together three times, and I think that's what's doing it. But I always have to restrain myself from trying out too many new things. There's a quote from one of my favorite books. It's actually not a gardening book, even though it's called My Summer in a Garden. That was written in the 1800s by Charles Dudley Warner, who was a contemporary and a friend of Mark Twain. And it's sort of a funny book. It's somewhat political, but it has a lot of nice little sayings about gardening. So he said, I've seen gardens which were all experiment, given over to every new thing, and which produced little or nothing to the owners except the pleasure of expectation. So I really have to restrain myself from, you know, I'm constantly like trying to, thinking I should test this, I should test that. I really wish I had an experiment station and a staff, and, you know, I could just design, you know, a whole bunch of experiments that I think would come out, would be quite interesting, but I don't. And, you know, I only have so much time. And also, I don't want to have the garden be all experiment. I like to get a good crop of peas and harvest tomatoes, too.
Yeah. You begin the book with a quote by Thomas Jefferson, which says, you know, I'm an old guy. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, I'm an old man.
I'm a young gardener.
How much does experience play? compared to the science, how much does experience play in having a good garden?
That's actually a great question, because people often say, I remember when I was starting out early, you know, people would say, well, I've been gardening for 30 years. And then, of course, you conjure up in your mind this wealth of information. And that's true to some degree. But the thing is, if you don't know what's going on in the garden, you know, some of the science behind it, you might have gardened for 30 years in one spot. And, you know, maybe you did things that had a result and you could attribute it to what you did. But it's not necessarily applicable to somebody else who you might be telling that to. It might be a different climate, different varieties of plants. So there's a lot of things that change. So I think knowing some of the science, I think experience is surely good, because obviously you learn a lot from experience, but you have to temper it with some knowledge of what might be driving what you've observed. And that's one benefit, I think, of this book, is that if you know some of what's going on in the garden, why things are happening, you can say, if you move somewhere new, which I did a few times with gardens, you can apply that knowledge to make things grow well, even at these new sites where you don't have experience there.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, use some of your experience there. And then the other thing is with the climate seems so wacky these days and changing. I think it makes for a more resilient gardener, also garden and gardener, if you can adapt, and you can better adapt if you know something of what's going on. You know, it reminds me of the first gardening book I wrote was back in 1990, and it was about, it was called The Northeast Gardener's Year, and it went week by week what to do. At the end of the book, I had a weekly schedule of things to do, and I thought, well, this is great. Now I don't have to start thinking, should I plant lettuce now? Should I not plant it? I'll just look at my schedule every year. And really, that schedule has to be changed. I mean, things have changed.
How far have they changed?
I would say it's
like a couple of weeks?
Maybe a week. You know, it used to be where I am, the average date, so it not necessarily happened every year, but on average, the date of the last killing frost in spring, which is, you know, important for, say, when you set out your tomato plants, would be the third week in May, say May 21st, around then. And for the last few years, we haven't had a frost after early May even, so it's at least a week.
Yeah.
And some years it'll be more, you know, have to wait for more years to get a new average. But I know the USDA, you know, publishes the various hardiness zones, and I can't remember when it was, but maybe it was 10 or 15 years ago, maybe a little more, they actually changed the hardiness zones for a lot of the country to warmer, because it just wasn't getting as cold.
Yeah.
It used to get reliably every single year to 25 below here at least once, and now it might touch minus 20 or maybe in minus 15, and some years it's only gone to minus 5. And I can really see that, because as with most gardeners, I'm always trying to push the limits of what I can grow. And there's certain plants that I grow that I know years ago I could not grow well because of cold, winter cold, and now I can.
You're in New Paltz, New York. Here in Oklahoma, I mean, a lot of times we're looking at winters in which a prolonged hard freeze, where you have like a week of temperatures that are well, you know, where you never get up above 25. There's some winters where we might have very little of that, maybe only a week or two.
Yeah.
And that's really, I imagine it's throwing gardeners off. And it's throwing you off in the Northeast. It's throwing gardeners off in Oklahoma, I would think.
Yeah, I have to say I sort of like that, though, because now I can plant plants that I can grow. I'm just waiting for it to get warm enough so I can grow citrus here. That's going to be a long wait. And of course, I'm not promoting anything that speeds up that process. I would rather not grow citrus.
My guest today is Lee Reich, a horticulturist, author, and syndicated gardening columnist. And his latest book is titled The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. Well, in the book, you take us through just about every scenario in the process of growing plants, beginning with propagation and planting. And one of the things you recommend, I don't know if this is really a Northeastern habit or this is good for anybody to get a start on the garden. A lot of times you'll see gardeners putting seeds in the fridge for a little while, especially in the late winter. But you do it with a little bit of potting soil, as opposed to just the seeds themselves in a plastic bag. What's going on there?
This is definitely not a Northeast gardeners only. This is everywhere in the temperate world, not in the tropics. Sometimes I like to grow trees from seed too. It's very rewarding, even though you start out with a smaller plant. Most hardy trees, when they drop their ripened seeds in late summer or fall, have this inhibition. The seeds are inhibited from growing because if they grew, then they'd be these little seedlings. They'd be exposed to winter and they'd die. So they have various mechanisms that hold them back. And one mechanism is they can sort of recognize cold. And I do go a little into the science of it. There's this hormone, natural plant hormone called abscisin. And when the seeds experience cool, moist conditions, the abscisin, which holds back germination, gradually decomposes. So after a certain amount of time of experiencing this cool, moist conditions, then the seeds will germinate. So I keep on emphasizing cool and moist because some people think, well, you just throw the seeds in the refrigerator or freezer. But it actually has to be moist. That's why the potting soil, because it keeps it moist. And also cool, not frigid. It's typically temperatures between about 30 and 45, which is refrigerator temperatures. So I'll take some seeds of a plant that ripens in the fall or even in the summer, and I'll put them in a plastic bag with some potting soil, keep them moist, put them in the refrigerator, and then the seeds are fooled into thinking winter's over, and I can get germination indoors earlier. And it's really fascinating to watch because in the refrigerator, it's almost like they have this time, or they do have this time clock. And for most, a lot of hardy seeds, it'll be like 1,000 hours, which comes out to about 2 months. And when that chilling bank, as I like to call it, is filled, all of a sudden the seeds almost germinate all at once. In the refrigerator, you all of a sudden see this baggie full of white root sprouts, and then you can plant them out, start them indoors, and get a jump on the season. And, you know, and other seeds have other types of dormancy. Some seeds have a very hard seed coat, in which case you take a file and you just file it just a little just to let some moisture get into the seed to help it to germinate. And some seeds, I mentioned, I think, in the book, tree peony seeds, have a double dormancy, one dormancy for the root and one for the shoot. So the double dormancy, the first thing it needs is a warm, moist treatment. So you put it in that little plastic bag with moist potting soil, and you keep it warm for 2 months, and then you put it in the refrigerator for 2 months. So it's a way to, you know, just get seeds. Obviously, in nature, these seeds sprout by themselves, but these are all ways, if you learn about the seeds, that you can get them to sprout under more controlled conditions. You can pot them up and plant them out. And it's really a way to get a lot of plants, and it's interesting and it's fun.
I was really interested in the little section on juvenility in plants. I have a couple of dogwood trees. They go through this juvenile phase where they don't bloom. And I just remember I was ready to cut them down because I could never get any blooms. And about the time I say, okay, one more spring, and then all of a sudden I'm starting to get blooms. But you say, you write in there about how that phase is far more different than in the plant than we probably see just from a casual look on the outside. The plant is really changing, much just like a an animal, you know, species.
Like any animal, it goes through a juvenile phase and puberty, and then once an adult, it can actually reproduce. And if you're growing for flowers, that's the reproductive structures. But the interesting thing also is that some plants do look quite different when they're juvenile than when they're adults. And the best example of that, I think, is English ivy, which is a very familiar plant, and people grow it as a vine. And the vine is actually the juvenile phase. And if you let English ivy grow for a long time, like my father had a really old plant against his house, and after a number of years, decades, the plant changes from juvenile to adult, and when it does that, one thing it does, of course, is flower, but the leaves change shape. Instead of being somewhat maple-shaped, more rounded, and the growth happens. Instead of being a vine, it becomes a shrub, and so it's really quite different. And, other trees have go through changes, too, like that. One typical change for juvenility, well, when a plant is juvenile, is it can have very large leaves, and this is sometimes plants are kept in a juvenile state just for that dramatic landscape effect.
A big part of the book is soil preparation. You know, I was reading through the section, I lived in two houses maybe 3 miles apart. One had such a clay soil that after a hard rain, you would watch all the water from the rain literally draw down the top of the grass down to a curb, and you would see wet curbs for 2 or 3 days in the neighborhood after any rainstorm because it was so clay. The other house was so sandy, it drained so quickly, it looked dry a day after. So I've had sort of extremes there. What's to keep in mind in looking at your soil and making sure that it's prepared to grow the plants you want to grow?
Yeah, well, soil is one of my favorite topics. It was actually one of my graduate degrees is in soils. And I would like to come up with, in answer to your question, with some, like, people love complicated formulas and things like that, and I wish I could come up with a complicated formula. But without hardly knowing anything about soil, whether you had a really sticky clay soil or really well-drained or too well-drained sandy soil, 99%, or say 90%, of getting the soil to be really, really good is just to add a lot of organic matter to the soil, like compost, leaves, straw, hay, wood chips, wood shavings, anything that is or was living has many physical, biological, and nutritional benefits in the soil. And really, besides the fact that you were talking about how the rain washing off the surface of a clay soil, that also physically it helps the soils absorb moisture better. You know, the main thing to do is to recycle as much organic matter into the soil as possible. And when I say into the soil, I don't really mean literally into, because in some cases, in many cases, it does not need to be and should not be dug into the soil. You can just lay it on top of the soil, and it will gradually work its goodness down into the ground.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, we were talking about compost. What makes the best compost? You were talking about some of the things you said. I might talk about some of the ingredients in good compost, but what are we throwing away in our household waste that might make good compost?
Well, surely kitchen waste, you know, vegetable trimmings, things like that, that definitely makes good compost. You know, leaves, when people rake up leaves in the fall and put them in bags to be picked up, I mean, that's a great source of organic material that can be used in compost or directly as mulch. Grass clippings are a good source of organic matter. I actually developed a deep respect for soil and a deep disrespect for landfills as a result. I mean, I hate the idea of just taking garbage or so-called garbage and just burying it in the ground. It just seems disrespectful to the ground. So I really have trouble throwing stuff out. So I started composting. Basically, I throw everything in my compost, you know, whether it's in the garden, diseased plants, you know, insect-ridden plants, everything goes in the compost pile. If you wait long enough, you know, it all gets chewed up. And then I was thinking even some of my old clothes, like if they're made of cotton or wool or even leather gloves. So on my website, I have a little funny thing about composting. Well, the funny part is that I show that I'm composting my old cotton underwear. and actually, that composts quite quickly, as opposed to I also composted an old pair of Levi's. And those actually are pretty tough pants. It's like a dryer cycle. It had to go through three cycles before it really started to be composted. And each time I took them out and held them up, and I guess the first time, or maybe it was the second time, they looked like sort of sheer, very sheer polyester pants. And then eventually I could recognize where the characteristic buckles and, not buckles, you know, the snaps and everything, right. and zipper. Yeah. But yeah, I throw everything in the compost. And you can just throw everything in. I think the most important thing for composting is to have a bin. If you have a bin that keeps everything contained, and if it's going to develop any heat, keeps the heat in, keeps scavengers out, and then it looks like a compost pile. It doesn't look like a garbage pile. And then if you do that and you want to do nothing else, you can learn about composting that helps speed up the process. But if you do nothing but have a bin and just throw everything in, no matter what you do, it will become compost eventually.
Now, you also put wood ash in your garden, too, right?
Well, I actually heat my house to a large extent with wood, so I get a lot of wood ash. So if I put it all in the garden, that would be... Wood ash is good, but it's you can have too much of a good thing. It's high in potassium and it's alkaline. I don't want to make my soil too alkaline, and I don't want to, you know, override with, you know, with too much potassium. So I have so much wood ash that I just start at one end of my property. I have 2 acres, and I just spread it over the whole property. I get plenty of wood ash. But if I had less, I would maybe sprinkle a little in the garden, maybe sprinkle a little in the compost, but not. I would not put it, like, you know, a thick layer anywhere. Too much of a good thing. You know, there's so many wasted resources that could be used for compost. I mean, wood ash is one, as I said, you know, grass clippings, leaves, old vegetable trimmings. You know, people are constantly throwing away stuff.
One of the areas I want to talk about is avoiding plant stress. Here in Oklahoma, the first freeze, you'll see an early freeze, you'll see blankets out all over the garden or on flowering plants. Late freeze is the same thing. But we also have, we're very prone to drought, especially from, you know, mid-July through mid-September, and really hot weather that can be unpredictable. For example, right now in early June, we're looking at temperatures near 100 degrees. This is usually prime tomato growing weather, you know, with highs in the 80s, usually the average, and yet already we're near 100 degrees. What are some of the strategies you can do to avoid some of these weird early season heat, early and late freezes?
Yeah, well, I lived in the upper Midwest for a number of years, so I know that how brutal the climate can be. And it sounds like it's even more brutal. I was in Wisconsin. Sounds like it's even more brutal in Oklahoma. But one thing you can do is, since part of the ways plants deal with stress is, you know, the roots can be stressed. So to limit the amount of stress to the roots, you know, make sure the soil is in really good condition. And not to be redundant, but that goes back to the organic matter. A lot of organic matter in the soil really makes them more able to tolerate various stress. You know, then there's also, so when plants get under heat stress, they're often under water stress too, because they're losing water, especially if they can't get enough moisture from the soil. Then, you know, they don't know where they should shut the stomates where water leaves the leaves, but also that's photosynthesis occurs. So shut the stomates so you stop water loss, but then you don't have photosynthesis, or do the opposite, and then you have too much water loss. So, watering, I think, is one of the most important things that people often get wrong, you know, watering either too much or too little. So I think correct watering is really important. And one of my favorite ways for watering a vegetable garden or any garden that really needs regular watering is with drip irrigation, because not only is it easier because you can set it up to go on and off automatically, but also it's better for the plants because it delivers water more at a rate that they like to use it, or that they do lose water, and it keeps the foliage dry so you don't get diseases. And then, you know, the other thing, I guess, if you're thinking long term with conditions like this, is a plant choice. You might want to, not growing all cacti, but growing plants that, you know, really can take a little stress. And then in your existing garden, if you're going to be watering by hand and you can't water everything, you know, practice triage, water things that need it the most. For instance, tomatoes can get by with less water than a lot of other vegetable plants. That's one thing.
Yeah, let me ask you about just the amount to water, because a lot of it varies. People say, I water a little bit every day. Should it be a lot every 2 or 3 days? Or does it really vary depending on your soil composition and where you live?
Well, it varies to some degree, but, you know, it will vary with the weather. You know, like you said, 100 degrees, sunny weather, a plant's going to lose a lot of water. So it varies with the weather, with how big the plants are, because it's how fast they're taking water out of the soil, what kind of soil you have. So there's a lot of, you know, you get very complicated about it. Or you can do a general rule of thumb, which is that plants need, on average, the equivalent of a 1-inch depth of water a week. So it's like if you had a straight-sided can out and rain fell and it was 1 inch, that would sustain plants, you know, on average for a week. So you can set up a sprinkler and add 1 inch a week. And the way a sprinkler works, you flood the soil. That will flood the soil. And then after gravity takes some of the water out of the soil, some air can get into it. Then the plants are happy, and then they get a little dry. Then you flood the soil again. This is why I like drip irrigation, because you can add a little water every day or multiple times during the day as plants use it. And to translate that 1 inch of water, say if you had like a new tree that you planted, you're not going to necessarily use a sprinkler and have cans. You're going to use a watering can. So that translates to about 3/4 gallon per square foot spread of the roots. So you just estimate how, you know, just a rough estimate of how much volume the roots are taking up. And then you convert that to square feet and 3/4 gallon once a week per square foot. The drip irrigation, you would do the, usually about a half an hour a day. You know, I've made complicated calculations, but a good rough guide is just a half an hour totally a day. But the water is only being dripped, so it's not a lot of water. Oh, and then the other final thing that I should mention that I'm sure everybody's familiar with is mulching. Mulching is really, you know, once you have the soil nice and moist, you mulch it, and that really keeps the moisture in, keeps a nice, even moisture in the soil.
I was really struck by a term I'd never heard, photoperiod, which probably gardeners, some gardeners have heard of. And it's, of course, when a plant goes dormant, when a plant comes out at the beginning of the spring. And one of the things I always thought it was based on sunshine, the amount of sunshine a plant's getting. It's actually it's actually the opposite. It's the length of darkness.
Right. Well, when photoperiod was just discovered, it was, I think, in the 1940s, two USDA scientists were working with a tobacco plant, and they noticed it flowered when there was a certain amount of daylight that it got exposed to, so it came to be called photoperiod. And they later found out that it wasn't daylight, it was actually night or darkness that the plant gets exposed to that determines, you know, whether it flowers or how it grows. But the sort of interesting and the important thing about photoperiod is if you're going to play around with photoperiod, which you can do, you want to be conscious of the amount of darkness. So say if, like a lot of times people want poinsettia plants to bloom by Christmas, and the way you do that is you give it an artificial photoperiod of, I can't remember, maybe it's less than 14 hours or something. I can't remember exactly what it is. But so when you give that photoperiod, the days are still too long for it to bloom naturally by Christmas, so you want to give it shorter days or really longer nights. So you can put it in the closet every day for a few hours or, you know, some totally dark room. But the thing is, if you go put in that closet, then you want to just take a look at it for some reason, and you come in there with a flashlight. It doesn't take a lot of light to throw off that photoperiod. So if you come in after 4 hours with a flashlight, all of a sudden that photoperiod has shortened, that night period has shortened to 4 hours instead of the requisite 10 hours or whatever it is, or 14 hours. So the darkness has to be total. You can't even give a little light, or the plant will think it.
So even if you just checking on it will screw it up. It'll say, "Oh, I got light."
Any light, yeah. And that really relates to a lot of things. The photoperiod is one factor. Cooler temperatures are another. Is what makes trees, you know, outdoor trees go dormant in the fall, and that's why often trees near streetlights don't go dormant as soon as trees that are not near streetlights, because they're getting this artificial light, you know, through the night, so they don't go dormant. And another way that this is really circuitous, the way it's related, I mentioned the book about tilling the soil. I'm a great proponent of not tilling the soil. I haven't tilled my vegetable gardens for years. And one advantage of that is you actually have less weeds if you don't till the soil, and the reason is because buried within every soil are weed seeds, and they're just waiting for light to germinate. So when you till the soil, you expose them to light, and then they wake up.
Well, interesting. There's lots of interesting facts in the book, The Ever Curious Gardener. Lee, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
Horticulturist and gardener Lee Reich speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. It's published by New Society Publishers. By the way, if you're looking for some more information for your backyard garden, you can't go wrong with the 12th annual open house at the Linnaeus Garden at Woodward Park coming up this Saturday from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.